From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Greece has demanded billions of euros in reparation payments from Germany for atrocities committed by the Nazis during World War II. Athens threatened to take legal action to make the Germans pay. This was Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras speaking in Komeno, where the German army massacred more than half the village's residents in August 1943 and torched it.
Greece and its people will not forget the slaughter and war crimes of the Nazi army and demand tangible recognition by the German government. Greece will do whatever is necessary, mainly at a diplomatic level and, if necessary, at a legal level.
Dr. Marina Prentoulos is a Syriza member of Greece's parliament. She told RT's Neil Harvey about the demand for reparations.
Crimes against humanity, they never expire. And the people of Greece always remember and always have to live with the memories of the Nazi occupation.
Eike Hammer, a political commentator based in Germany, who has been a longtime critic of Greece, disagreed.
I think there's hardly any other country that has got so much money from Germany than Greece. I think there's hardly any other comparison. If you calculate it together, you have hundreds of billions of euros paid for Greece.
In reply, Dr. Prentoulos recited some of the relevant history of relations between the two countries.
Greece is getting one of the worst treatments across the Eurozone. But if you want to talk about the situation in Greece now, I have to remind you again about the 1953 London Debt Agreement, when the whole world, a lot of countries, including Greece, decided to cut the debt of the German state by half. And this is not the treatment that Greece has. The Greek people have been totally brought to their knees.
It's been 63 years since the notorious U.S. and U.K. orchestrated coup against Iran's first democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, took place in 1953. The coup was completed on August 19th of that year, overthrowing Mossadegh, who had nationalized Iran's oil production in 1951, previously under British control. The Prime Minister's move was a source of serious tension with the U.S. and U.K. In 2013, the CIA released documents formally acknowledging the role it played, along with the British spy agency MI6, in the coup. The overthrow of Mossadegh strengthened the dictatorial rule of Iran's then-deposed Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who had just fled Iran following a power struggle with the Prime Minister. American activist and political commentator Phil Wiledo said the West's move to mount a coup against Mossadegh was aimed at preventing Iran from becoming a truly independent country.
Iran was the first country in the world to nationalize its oil and pay the price. The stand that Dr. Mossadegh took was tremendously popular throughout the Middle East, and he became a hero in the eyes of millions and millions of people because he correctly pointed out that it's impossible to have political independence without economic independence. And so, you know, he pursued the nationalization of Iran's own oil, which had been lost as a result of deals that previous leaders, corrupt leaders, had made with the British, and signed away the birthright of the Iranian people. So Dr. Mossadegh took it upon himself to reclaim that birthright and became a hero in the eyes of people around the world. So he was targeted, and when his government was overthrown.
Turkey's foreign minister lashed out at NATO Wednesday, saying the alliance is not fully cooperating with his country's government. In an interview with Sputnik News, Foreign Minister Mevlüt Cavusoglu suggested that Ankara would consider military cooperation with Russia.
It seems to us that NATO members behave in an evasive fashion in issues such as exchange of technology and joint investments. In this sense, if Russia were to treat this with interest, we are ready to consider the possibility of cooperation in this sector.
RT's Gayan Chichikayan reports.
Even though Washington says Turkey is still a good ally and the partnership is strong, there seems to be a disconnect between what U.S. officials say and what Turkish leadership expresses. The Turkish foreign minister went as far as to describe Turkey as being treated by the U.S. and NATO as, quote-unquote, a second-class country.
They consider Russia and Turkey to be second-class countries, and they are outraged that these second-class countries dare to criticize them. Therefore, faced with the straightforwardness and resilience of Erdogan and Putin, they feel very worried and anxious.
Earlier this month, Turkey also suggested that Russia and Turkey carry out joint operations against ISIL in Syria. Turkey also says it is negotiating with Iran on a strategy in Syria. Remember, this is Turkey that not so long ago supported efforts to oust Syria's Bashar Assad and opposed Russia's policy of fighting against terrorists in Syria through helping the Syrian army. Well, Turkey now says, and I quote here, "We have repeatedly stated, even in the period of crisis in our relations, that it would be impossible to achieve a lasting resolution in Syria without Russia's participation. We continue to insist on this. The same can be said about Iran, with which we are negotiating at the moment as well and aim to strengthen cooperation in this sphere." It should be said that there has been quite a bit of tension between Washington and Ankara, and Turkey has made all kinds of accusations against the U.S., accused them of supporting terrorists, of siding with coup plotters, but Washington sort of tried to make it seem as if it is business as usual, but it has been more and more difficult to do. But despite all this tension that is there, still Turkey remains a NATO ally and a member of the U.S.-led anti-ISIL coalition, but its role in the alliance is becoming stranger by the day.
Meanwhile, the United Nations welcomed an announcement by Russia that it plans to join a cessation of hostilities in and around Syria's city of Aleppo for humanitarian purposes. A UN deputy spokesperson said trucks with food, water, and medicine were ready to move into the area immediately. The UN's special envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, said the organization will work out the operational details of a 48-hour humanitarian ceasefire in Aleppo with Russia to allow quick delivery of aid to civilians there. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it was ready to support a proposal by de Mistura for weekly 48-hour pauses in fighting around Aleppo. The ministry said the first pause was set to begin next week. Turkey's relationship with NATO and Russia and the war in Syria were among the topics of discussion at this week's press conference with Maria Zakharova, spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry. She also discussed recent developments in Ukraine, legacy issues regarding visas for people in the former Soviet republics, a joint commemoration with the UK of cooperation during World War II between London and Moscow, and more. She also answered questions from the media at the press conference which took place in Moscow Thursday.
Maria, quick question. Can we give a bottom line of our Russian and Turkish bilaterals across many fields? Have we managed to reach a certain rapprochement to somehow closen up our positions on several tracks? And in this regard, another question. Does the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Lavrov, is going to visit Turkey? I dispose no information as to the second part of your question, but the key thing here is we discussed the most important things on our agenda. We had tensions on some tracks, but these tensions can be addressed through either constructive and meaningful efforts, such as negotiations on international fora, or we can try to neglect, we can pay no attention to each other and pretend that the other party does not exist. So now we are trying to move towards the first scenario. We started analyzing the Syrian track with our Turkish counterparts, and we deemed this effort to be quite meaningful. We both understand that the current tensions cannot be addressed with overnight. Those are quite substantial. Yet the effort is underway, and we think that it's a meaningful effort, and we will continue it across many fora and many scenarios. At least that's the position of the Russian side. Next question, please. NTV TV channel, Alexei Sidorov. Could you please provide any insight on the scandal around the documentary made by Sky News? Journalists made a claim that they managed to make an interview of a mercenary from Russia who allegedly took part in a ground operation in Aleppo. Recently, we found out that an actor from Moscow, Alexander Agapov, actually took part in this, in the entire performance. Will Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs respond somehow to the situation, and could you provide any general comment? Well, your question actually surprised me, especially the wording of your question. You started with saying that Sky News prepared a documentary. Do you actually believe it's a documentary? Well, that's a fiction in my book. That's a fiction where actors performed, and perhaps it was initially conceived as a documentary, but then it ended up as a fiction. It happens. Well, we do have our opinion, and I'm not quite sure if we even can call it a documentary.
Sky News в рамках медиа империи
We are talking about the Mr. Murdoch media empire, the footage of allegedly Russian mercenaries fighting in Syria, but thanks to Russian journalists, and especially from NTV, Russian TV channel, we came to know that it's indeed a fiction, a feature film with a Moscow-based actor Alexander Agapov featuring in this, who got a fee of over 100,000 rubles. For his work, well, it's quite a lucrative job, I should say. Anyhow, I should say that the plot of the movie is an ill-conceived and rather poorly performed bogus of a movie. And besides, one thing is quite noteworthy.
Чуть ли не сфабриковано и не сделано самой российской стороной. И такое было.
Almost immediately we heard some people saying that it was actually made by Russia, but I would like to discourage any further discussions of this idea. In a couple of days, on August 12th, Sky News was accused by Romanian authorities in disseminating untrustworthy information on illegal weapon trade in Romania. So perhaps it's not even a feature film, sounds like a TV series to me. I think that this kind of media produce, they chip away at the status of any media that considers itself a noteworthy source of information. It would be redundant to undertake any measures against the journalists working in Moscow. I don't think it even makes any sense. They have discredited themselves so good that they're done as journalists. And once again, I think they can gain a good source of income. For instance, if they find their dedication, their commitment in other genres, they can go into fantasy and make some Harry Potter movies and so on and so forth. I think it's not the first time we touch upon the issue of this dubious journalism that's especially vivid on the example of Murdoch-style journalism, and, well, Great Britain itself knows this, his methods and techniques quite well. Unfortunately, no global conclusions were drawn vis-a-vis this this approach, and somehow these kind of people and this kind of quote-unquote tradesmen sometimes come in handy. Perhaps not everyone knows, but journalists of Mr. Murdoch's media concern, seemingly encouraged by the leadership, are waging another anti-Russian campaign, and this time they're trying to discredit the British branch of the Russia Today TV channel and Sputnik agency. So Times and Sunday Times newspapers published some articles claiming that the Russian media should be accused of manipulating British public opinion, end of quote. And the example was quite simple. First, they promoted voting for Brexit, and now they promote separatism in Scotland. If we make the next logical step, the next logical move would be to close this media outlets altogether. But once we go into this matter, I have a suggestion for all the media and information agencies who engage in this anti-Russian paranoia, and in particular to Murdoch's empire. Perhaps you should actually count how many times British politicians and establishment have mentioned Russia in the context of Brexit. What does it have to do with Russia Today anyhow? Mentioning Russia in the context of referendum was a thing that British politicians applied to, not Russian journalists. That's a hack job, that's a dirty job for sure. Well, that's the best comment as any. That's as good as I can get. But it does inspire some repulsion when we hear about new piece of news like that. Next question, please.
Агентство Интерфакс Вероника Кушникова.
Interfax Agency.
Спецпосланник ООН по Сирии Стефан Демистура.
Special envoy for Syria, Stephen Demistura, required urgent imposition of a 24-hour pause of ceasefire in Syria due to grievous humanitarian situation in Aleppo. What's the Russian stance in this regard, and are we, is Moscow ready to such an urgent imposition? Yesterday there was a comment from Minister Lavrov on humanitarian corridors. That's a very well-founded position, grounded on a good understanding and thorough understanding of the situation, and I should only redirect you to his statement. Next question, please. Good afternoon. Tajikistan newspaper here. A letter was sent to you on a grievous violation of the rights of Tajikistan citizens, and I think this material was published in Komsomolskaya Pravda newspaper. The reference was made to the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games 2016. Have you got the chance to get acquainted with the material? Unfortunately, I did not. I was on vacation, but I will look through my correspondence and I will give you a profound response. I promise you, this will be done. The matter at hand is... Well, let me interrupt you. Once I get the chance to read it, I will give my comment. Thank you. Next question, please. Korean Broadcasting Agency, KBS. Ms. Zakharova, we have a question on on-air strikes of Russian airspace forces that have been proceeding from base in Iran. Are there any diplomatic negotiations with Iran on the terms during which Russian airspace forces will be authorized to use this air forces base? This question should be directed to the Ministry of Defense. They interact with their counterparts. And indeed, there are diplomatic communications, but mostly that's a matter that the Ministry of Defense deals with. Next question. Russia Today, Arab Edition, please. Despite the fact that you called Russia and Washington dealing constructively and meaningfully in Syria, media often are predicting soon failure of these negotiations, given the fact that Moscow often reproaches Washington for failure to differentiate terrorists and moderate opposition. What would be your insight on the Syrian track? And also any comments perhaps on renaming of Dushanbe, the Dushanbe authority's decision to rename some of the streets? As far as Russo-American track is concerned and the fact that media are promoting, hard-pedaling this idea of undermining the agreements, I can corroborate that the process that is undergoing now is complicated indeed. That's a diplomatic slash military negotiation on all the modalities and aspects of our cooperation. It's a negotiation of a mechanism. A mechanism should be established for cooperation. So, for instance, if there is someone willing to undermine this effort or this effort to be undermined, this is their bias and nothing else. We are doing everything possible. We spare no effort to make these negotiations and this everyday effort a success. We have no other understanding, no other interpretation of this stage, other than that it is being faithful. Some media outlets are indeed predicting the failure of the negotiations, yet they never question the fate of civilian population who inhabit Syria still, who die in airstrikes, who die from attacks of terrorists and moderate opposition alike. They should be aware that the process is an ongoing, that it endures during several years, and if no particular steps will be made on behalf of powers that can actually make an impact, make a difference, the conflict may protract for the same number of years. And only God knows how many people will die. So for those who are trying to look into particular destinies of particular people who suffered from this war, they should remember the fate of the entire nation that is also at stake. This close-up of a particular person, of a particular Syrian, it's undoubtedly important. Every human life is priceless, but the nation's destiny is at stake, and it's somehow being factored out of the discussion. So we should not get entangled in this juxtaposition. Our understanding is that we should do everything possible to make these arrangements a success, to make these arrangements come true. As far as our reproaches towards Washington, we're not criticizing, we're giving our objective comments on inability of Washington to differentiate terrorists from moderate opposition. To somehow formulate the definition of a moderate opposition. Why Minister of Foreign Affairs mentions this so often, and experts do as well? This is a cornerstone. This is something that the entire position is hinged upon. If a moderate opposition will be somehow distinguished, there will be no questions from either side. There will be no questions on who should be aimed, who should be the aim of the airstrikes.
гибели гражданского населения. Все было бы достаточно просто.
And the same logic would apply for those journalists claiming, writing about the deaths among the civilian population. The thing is that the U.S. should take the responsibility and do so publicly, for instance, during a meeting on an international forum, that they are ready to undertake this effort, so the effort will be done. They promised us this through expert channels. This is a matter of days, matter of weeks, and this matter of weeks keeps going on and on and on for months. Unfortunately, we are driving ourselves in a dead end, and we're not talking about criticizing, we're not talking about reprimands. There's more to the process than that. The essence is to find the root of all evil, to root cause of the problem.
As for the question on Tajikistan, could you please repeat it? Is there a kind of cooperation between Russia and Iran with the use of this base in Iran? Do you have this similar cooperation in Iraq? You know, the issue of using bases in Iraq should be directed to our colleagues in the Minister of Defense. Could you please repeat your question on Tajikistan? Thank you. What comments would you give on the decision of the Dushanbe authorities to rename the streets that bore the names of the famous men of culture, science, and arts? Of course, I'm aware of the situation. I read some articles and I heard about the decision taken by the authorities to change the names of the streets. Namely, we're talking about the streets that bear names of heroes of the Great Patriotic War, as well as people of culture, science, and arts of the Soviet period. I also saw that it caused an uproar in local media. On top of that, I also know that well-known and established historians and men of culture advocated for maintaining the existing names of the streets because it has to do with the glorious pages of our history, and I'm hopeful that the voice of these famous people, and in particular the voice of veterans, will be heard by the authorities. Your question, please.
Good afternoon.
Finnish TV Broadcasting Agency. During the meeting of the Russian president with the president of Kazakhstan, President Nazarbayev said that the Ukrainian president is ready for a compromise on the Donbas issue. Do you know what kind of compromise was mentioned? I think that you should direct a question to Ukraine, namely to the Ukrainian president's administration. I have no precise information on this issue. We're engaged in a constructive dialogue in the context of existing channels in order to settle the crisis in Ukraine. I think that you should ask representatives of Mr. Poroshenko about what they really meant. But of course, we need to break this stalemate. You can call it compromise or something else. Maybe you should use another the term, not a compromise, but there is a need for Kyiv to fulfill the obligations that the president took, as well as others who pledged to fulfill the Minsk agreements. This is something that we need most of all. We need to make sure that the obligations which are so badly needed for Ukraine itself are fulfilled, especially if Kyiv considered the Donbas and its population as being a part of a united country.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.